Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Senate Committee on Agricultural and Natural Resources. It's Wednesday, May the 19th, and at this time I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3295. And Representative Montgomery, if you want to head on up, I'll ask Brad to tell us a bit about the bill, and we'll hear from you.
Thanks, Senator George. For the record, my name is Bob Montgomery from District 56. That's the heart of the Columbia River Gorge, Cascade Lock, where it never rains. But we do grow very good grapes there, by the way. But I do appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today on House Bill 3295. This is at the request of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. This bill will authorize highway directional signs noting federally recognized wine grape districts in the state of Oregon. Highway signs will increase the public awareness of the variety and uniqueness of our grape growing districts. I support the Oregon wine grape industry. It's an industry that has grown in size and recognition over the past several decades. In my district alone, there are 8 vineyards producing several tons of quality wine grapes a year. It is my understanding that ODOT is okay with the bill, and there will be no public dollars used to produce the signs. The association is merely seeking the authority to pursue the signs. Oregon Wine Growers Legal Counsel is here today also to explain the details, I believe. And additionally, we have some people from the Oregon Wine Growers Association who I think will come before you and get into the details. I think it's a good idea. It advertises the products that we have, and I know, Mr. Chairman, you have some good wineries in your district also, so I thank you and ask for your support. Thanks very much for holding the hearing, and hopefully a work session.
Bob, you addressed some of my initial concerns that I had, and that was, you know, we didn't want to have the whole country covered up with a bunch of signs, but we see that it's very well dealt with in the existing statute, how the Department of Transportation will make that decision. They said they're very cautious in how they handle this, but at the same time, we recognize that, this production and sales is becoming a major issue, plus the fact that we have a lot of people now that are vineyard tourists. Napa Valley, but from other parts of the country, you know, to see the vineyard.
I almost forgot. There's probably some grapes down in Cottage Grove way, too, Mr. Chairman, but I'm just waiting over here, just waiting to jump all over you.
Yes, sir, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corbin.
Senator Wilde.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only grapes we probably have in Northport are our sour grapes. But anyway, I'm curious, and for others who come up to talk about this, why is this industry so interested in deadly green glass? You don't know the troubles it causes in terms of our SB 940, as I recall. And I'm just really curious, because having just carried the bill on the floor and having had dealt with the deadly green issue, I'm just curious if you know why they have to use deadly green glass.
I don't know what you're talking about, Senator, here, Mr. Chairman, Senator. Well, I have no idea what you're talking about.
You'll hear about it when SB 940 makes it over.
So I'll probably vote no on that on the House side. Or should I vote yes? I'll vote yes on that on the House side, Senator. Thank you, sir.
Senator Corcoran, did you have a question?
Yeah, Representative Montgomery, I'd be more than willing to support this bill if you will acknowledge that the wine in Lorain is better than the wine up in the Good River, number one.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, I think he has a good point that needs further discussion.
Okay, that's what's up. That's all good out of you.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
Oh, I have one other question. Will the signs be doubled up for people that have been to the wine tasting thing?
Senator, you have a very interesting committee, and I envy you. Thank you very much.
Doug Tyndall, where am I? Where am I? Oh, hey, you don't need to come up. Are you folks okay with this? You think that your management is... Oh, we're not moving this bill. We're in public hearing. And we have more...
Okay. Good. Bernie Lurch, Ivan Wells, and Jeff Leon, please come up.
What we can do, since there's 4 of you, if one of you want to take the mic to the side, and of course, you guys have probably done this before, state your name for the record, and we'll let you decide who's going to go first, and then do that.
Hello?
and I can give him the brief explanation on long testimony and short votes.
Actually, we're stalling for a quorum right now.
Good morning, or I guess good afternoon, so. Chairman George, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bernie Lurch. I'm the president of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I'm also the owner-proprietor of Hood River Vineyard winery operation in Hood River. I'd be happy to answer and entertain that question on Dead Leaf Green if you'd like.
I actually was semi-serious.
I understand it does create some problems for recycling. There's a lot of historical rationale for Dead Leaf Green. It was, but it also has enormous protective value for wine. Wines are a very delicate food group. And if they spend any time on a shelf where there's a lot of light, they can be damaged quite easily. And the Dead Leaf Green bottle provides the most protection that we can get in a bottle. Now that's the primary rationale. The historical side to Dead Leaf Green has been around for a very long time too. It was easier to produce those bottles in the early days. And many of the Dead Leaf bottles are of a hock origin, which means they're German origin. And the Germans perfected the technology for making these bottles in the early days. And so we've kind of carried that on into the present time period.
I realize this doesn't have to do with the bill, and I'm sorry, but since I did hear you, such as a deep brown glass would not be as light resistant, or at least ultraviolet probably light resistant.
No, it would not be, but it provides a fair amount of protection too. But brown bottles are more often associated with brewed beverages than.
Well, that's the association, but I want to talk about the light transmission. Do you think that the Dead Leaf Green actually prevents more of probably the ultraviolet rays passing through the glass?
I think it does, yes.
Okay.
You guys can assure me that Dead Leaf Green paint will be used on a sign here. No. Isn't it actually, too, if you're talking... bottling in that bottle, because we see... California, for example.
Everybody does.
Bottle?
Yes, they do. Everything from the Dead Leaf through the Champagne Green through the Flint. Those are the three principal bottles that you'll see. If you put everything back in the Flint bottles, they're not used for a couple of reasons. One is they don't provide the protection, obviously, but they're also more expensive. Clear bottles, by their nature, they can't clear the molds as easily, so they have to charge more to make a clear bottle. And so you won't see that for those two very reasons there. But all the bottles are used by the whole industry. Actually, throughout the whole world, you'll find the use of those bottles pretty much in the same fashion. Okay. With that aside, back to the bill. Obviously, I'm very happy to support this bill. We're entering an era in Oregon wine that it's time for... There's always a lot of questions that people ask, and the appellation system is a system that's been in place in Europe for a very long time, and in the United States it's only been part of the process for about the last 25 years or so, and it's a recognition system for viticulture or agricultural areas, and by defining those areas, it helps everybody, the consumer. It helps them to understand better the kind of fruit that's grown in that particular region. From a producer standpoint, it provides a uniqueness. The French would call it terroir, where you're looking at these defined characteristics. Cottage Grove, for example, has a unique terroir. Hood River has a unique terroir. By having the appellations that define these areas, then the consumer has a better knowledge for and understanding for the products that come out of those areas. And from a marketing perspective, from the ability to sell our product, by being able to put these viticultural areas and these appellations, these defined areas on our labels, then it's much easier for us to be able to sell our product. And so obviously that's been a very important consideration.
But
carefully tailored description of each wine growing area.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the most important considerations in this matter. You know, this is an industry that's growing very rapidly. We're adding about 5 wineries per year. We have been for the last half a decade or more. There's no sign that that's going to diminish. And I think that we're mainly an industry of small farmers, and that anything that gives us a little bit of an edge is definitely appreciated. And our reputation really is pretty profound when you consider our small size. And if we can ship a product into an area that really doesn't know much about, other than the fact that Oregon is in the Northwest, if you have some characteristics that can go back on that label and help them to understand exactly what's produced there, then it's a value. We currently have 5 appellations in the area, so we really have 5 distinct growing regions. We're soon to have a 6th. We're working on one for our area, Hood River, as well. And I think that each of those areas in time will probably be subdivided into additional appellations, because what you find is that these areas are, an example would be Columbia Valley Appellation, which actually is by state. It starts out in the Yakima Valley, it comes down the Columbia, and it encompasses both sides of the river, so both Washington and Oregon are included. But it's a huge appellation. And there are actually many areas within that appellation that could easily be subdivided and easily shown to be unique. And when we talk about uniqueness, we're talking about soils, obviously, but we're talking about more things. The climate, the microclimates can vary enormously. My area, for example, which in the gorge you have enormous influence of the marine influence coming through the gorge, and we get a lot of rain that comes through there. We have a lot of elevation gain and loss, so each, depending on where you are elevation-wise, you can have different microclimates. And then we also face the desert on the east, so the gorge often acts like a vortex. The winds move back and forth from the east to west. So some days you can have a predominantly marine influence, and the next day you can have predominantly a desert influence. Well, in each one of those confines, you're going to have a lot of variation on the theme. So the fruit that's grown there can be profoundly different. And that's the rationale behind having these. And I think by definition, if we can then show people as they enter this area by having these wonderful signs, I think then they're going to be a more of awareness. In my area, and just like in many other fruit-bearing regions of Oregon, you'll often find, as you drive along the roads, you'll see signs that say, identify hazelnuts. In our area, you don't see hazelnuts, but you do see Anjou pears mentioned, or Newtown pippins. And so people get more of an awareness of the ag base and the rationale for why all these things are there. And it makes them, they become curious, they become interested, and they want to learn more. I mean, what we find in our industry is that I think sometimes 70% of what I do is education. People come in and they ask questions. And they ask many questions that you sometimes have to wonder how far away they have been from agriculture. I mean, we get people coming in February and they say, so why aren't there any grapes on your vines now? And in fact, they seem to be dead. You know, and so we spend a lot of time explaining agriculture and the rationales there and what we do. But we also make them more aware of the complexity of growing fruit, the complexity of taking that fruit and turning it into a world-class wine. So it's all part of a process that's very important to us as an industry, but I think it's also very important to Oregon, because this is part of Oregon's identity. And this is an identity that gets translated into a lot of different areas that's oftentimes quite confusing. I mean, most of Americans, unfortunately, are separated by many generations from agriculture. And the more we can do to make them more aware of what we do, I think the more likelihood they're going to understand us and our problems. And they are legendary, and they're not going to go away. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Am I being heard? Okay, I guess I am. My name is Ivan Wells. I'm the legislative chair for the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I wish to thank you all for hearing our bill today, and I know you're going to pass favorably on it. You can't do anything else. But well, I have some prepared testimony, which I think you have, but what I'd like to do is show you the different wine-growing regions we have in Oregon. Now, one of my best training handouts is this little brochure, and I hope you have some, because we've probably got enough for 10 for everybody that's in the room today or so. Anyway, as we open the page, it shows an Oregon wine label, and the next page over, it talks about the wine regions of Oregon. And then there's a map on the back, large fold-out. We don't have center folds. We have end folds that shows the different wine regions here. Recently, well, in April, I was in touring through France and Germany and Switzerland and so forth like this. But what immediately grabbed my attention and going down the Autobahn was seeing the large signs that said Champagne, or the various Mosel, or the Rhone, or the various other wine-growing regions. Now, it all didn't have to say very much, because I knew what Champagne meant, I knew what Rhone was, but if I knew if I was going to visit that area, I was either there or had to turn off and go down this direction. And I think that's what our bill is trying to do. People who are wine knowledgeable from other areas, from other countries, other cities, other continents, come to our area trying to learn where our wines are grown and what makes our wines unique. When I was in Austria, I visited a small shop. By the way, wherever I visited in 2 weeks' time, I handed out one of these in Europe, in seven different countries.
I mean, are the models, the signs, the centers, in Europe?
I'd say something very simple kind of a sign. No, it's still under consultation with transportation. So I don't see a clutter of signs. I see something simple because the wine people know the regions because they see it on the labels. You know, as they come from around the country, they would be looking for these particular regions. So we think we have a very simple bill.
If I could just interject something along the same lines. There are many states. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Bernie Lurch again. Many states in the United States currently have programs very similar to this. New York State, Michigan, Massachusetts, Connecticut. States actually have very small wine growing regions, but they have a wonderful signage system up, and they are not. They're not obnoxious at all, but they do provide a lot of useful information. And these are areas that don't have much of a wine industry, unlike our own. And that's, you know, I think it is time for us as well.
I don't want to rush you folks, but I had someone just lean over and whisper in my ear, remember you now have four votes here.
Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jesse Lyon. I am a general counsel for the Oregon Wine Growers Association with Davis Wright Tremaine. I just want to clarify about three legal questions that have come up over the course of this bill. First is how BATF designates viticultural areas. BATF may establish these areas only where the name is locally or nationally known. The region has geographical features that Bernie had talked about that are distinct from the surrounding areas, and the history of grape production evidences the boundaries of the region. Again, that's under federal law. And so it's these characteristics which we want to call attention to in Oregon's wine industry in particular.
What is the implication of that designation? I mean, what does it gain for us?
That primarily that gains the ability to designate that on the labels.
It's kind of when I saw a Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco Firearms and the first look at the bill, it was, well,
Mr. Chairman,
how that works.
Those once they are recognized, they're printed in the Federal Register and it becomes part of the law, federal law. The second issue just concerns federal highway sign criteria. Under federal law, privately owned scenic and cultural attractions that are regionally known and of outstanding interest to the traveling public are eligible for directional signing. And this is the same standard that Oregon applies in its state highway law. And we are just asking you to clarify that it meets that standard. And federal highway authorities are particularly deferential to what state officials deem to be scenic areas of beauty or historical significance. So we certainly believe that we qualify, and this wouldn't pose any threat to federal highway program funds. And then finally is the sign permit fee issue. We recognize that permits will be required. Wine industry interests will apply for those permits and pay for the fees. And because of this, there is no additional permit fee language or funding language required of the bill. And the permitting process will also ensure that ODOT is okay with the text and placement and size of the signs. And that's all I have. So if you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them for you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3295, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3295.
Mr. Chairman, I move HB 3295 for a due pass recommendation.
Wilder move House Bill 3295 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 3295 has been passed. Will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And who would like to carry it?
I will carry it.
I'm too quick.
I have lots of figures.
Okay, I'm going to open up a work and Brad, we have Senator Castillo,
Putting the room or something.
I'll let you decide if you're going to go first. Take your name for the record.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm Peter Courtney, State Senator for District 17 of 9th Chamber. I'm Peter Courtney, the State Senator from Little District 17 here in Salem-Keizer. And what I'd like to do is, Senator Castillo, would you like to say something or just go right to Bob and just cut to the chase? Let's go right to Bob and cut to the chase because we got stashed two amendments, which are our amendments, and dash three amendments, which are the... I don't know how to refer to the dash three amendments. How should we?
I don't know if we do. Do you have dash three? We don't have dash
three. You don't have? You don't have dash two?
Oh, okay. Well.
Just 1 second. Let's get our act together here.
Senator Courtney?
Yes, Senator. Ma'am.
You seem a little sleepy. Were you at Star Wars this morning?
There's a reason she asked me that, and I could go into it, but I won't. I could go into that.
My staff was at Star Wars today. I'm just curious now.
Just checking here.
Okay. Thank you. Bob, you want to talk about where we're at in the ministry? Bob, proceed, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. The history of Senate Joint Resolution 38 is that St. Pius X Catholic Church in Cedar Mill in Washington County had done work as a parish in farm worker housing camp rehabilitation of units and were concerned because of what they discovered in their trying to rehabilitate these units that there needed to be a task force. So therefore, Senate Joint Resolution was drafted. Senator Peter Courtney graciously agreed to introduce it with the co-sponsors that are listed on the bill. Subsequent to the printing of the bill, the SJR 38-2 and -3 amendments were produced in a way in which community groups that were in the original printed version of the bill thought to be necessary to the discussion have been deleted from the composition of the task force, namely representatives of farm worker unions and legal services representatives. The idea behind the task force was to bring the knowledgeable people who either live in these situations, work with the people, or represent these people so that they could bring their concerns to the table, to the attention of a task force. Since those people have been proposed to be deleted in either the Dash 2 or the Dash 3 amendments, those requesting organizations feel that they can no longer support the bill if either the Dash 2 or the Dash 3 amendments are adopted. As a matter of fact, in discussion yesterday with the representatives of the requesting community organizations, if the Dash 2 or Dash 3 amendments are adopted by the committee, then respectfully, the community organizations that requested to be named on the face of the bill would now request to be removed from the face of the bill.
They don't believe that.
Have you seen the answer?
We have.
Okay. Don't you believe that the new process was established well? We're going to need to know. Can do an area of
public. Mr. Chair, we're not reluctant to add people to the task force. If additional knowledgeable people will benefit the legislature's review of this subject matter, we are more than willing to add people to the task force. What the community organizations requesting the bill are reluctant to do is to delete knowledgeable people who either come from farm labor organizations such as a union or their representatives. These are the people who are probably most knowledgeable and most articulate about the issue. I read in today's Statesman Journal a newspaper article recounting the governor's visit to a farm labor camp yesterday. And to my chagrin, I read from a quote attributed to or paragraph referring to a representative of an agricultural entity that there was concern about collective bargaining being raised or unionizing efforts being raised in the context of this task force. The task force is limited to farm worker housing, despite the fact that there may be other issues out there in the agricultural community. A task force dedicated to farm worker housing really has no authority to branch out into collective bargaining or unionizing, organizing type issue areas. So we're really chagrined that a task force that was contemplated as dedicated exclusively to farm worker housing issues would be denied the participation of people who represent and are most knowledgeable about the conditions on a statewide basis.
Mr. Chair, while we're waiting, the last time we had a hearing on this, one of the members of the panel said that they didn't care if the Pope's name was on it. They could do anything with the bill they wanted. I guess what I would ask the panel is, would you prefer that they use another vehicle other than the vehicle that you've created if they want to create their own task force without representation of by Pacoon or without representation by legal counsel? Yeah, I'm asking you guys that question.
Well, I think it's Mr. Chair, Chair George, Senator Corby, the position we find ourselves in is that there's a lot of organizations, individuals that are on this resolution, and to add to the groups of the area here is we're wide open on, you know what I mean, to bring more people to the table so that we get a, you know, to get the players to the table, because that's how you know, in this business that we're in, that's how you get work groups, and that's how you bring people together so you get consensus, either at committee level or on the floor level or on big issues. We're all for that, and we can accept that. But to start to roll back from where we're at puts us in somewhat of an, well, puts us in an untenable situation. So however we need to get off our names on this, we would, or, yeah, if you're committed, if you, Chair George, or still going to move in this direction, and I would respectfully request, I had a very sensitive situation developed up this year.
The question that Brad is
Chair.
Let me finish this conversation with Ms.
I did something to, I've actually left you the situation similar to this Judiciary Committee between two of your caucus members where there was a bill with one of your caucus members' name on it. And we amended the bill such that she couldn't vote for it and created a real firestorm. And I went to meet with her and the chair, got the bill brought back to committee, and we amended it in a way that everybody could support it because her name was on, so she didn't have to take it off. Because I pointed out the chair didn't realize, you don't do that. That's a very, you know, and we worked it out. I would hope we could do that as opposed to that you could find ways to accommodate the what we're trying to do here, maybe add on some people so that we can stay on board because we don't want to get off to a bad start as opposed to having you move in another direction. I you can tell.
Testifying in the bill, I had somebody try to get my chair and the vice chair's bill right before our very eyes.
Right.
So I'm very sensitive to that, and that's why we were responsive as we approached and joint rep.
Right.
Chair, members of the committee, it's my understanding that the anybody's names can be removed from the bill by simply submitting a written statement to the Secretary of the Senate asking to be removed from the bill, and then when the bill is printed and engrossed, they will be removed.
Okay. Mr. Chair, it'd be my impression that Senator Castillo and Senator Courtney are fully capable of figuring out how to get their names removed from the bill. I think you're missing the point. The point is you're attempting the same gut and stuff that you're angry about. So if that's the game you want to play, why don't you just tell folks you're going to play that game, put the growers' amendments in, vote the thing up, be done, and then they can have their names removed.
So I hope we don't have any complications. If those amendments are going to be run, please
Mr. Chair,
that's
kind of interesting because, you know, the old saying, what goes around comes around. In 1995, I had the great privilege of standing up on the House floor and getting my name removed from a bill that I had that former Representative Courtney had worked over in one of his committees with the help of several other people. It was something that I could not support, and I'm happy to say that my efforts, along with others, we were able to kill the bill that came out. So this is not something that's just been contemplated here momentarily.
Mr. Chair?
There has been improvement in the Dash 3 amendments. I'm not saying that the Dash 3 amendments have not tried to accommodate us to a certain extent, and the improvement is found in that the requirement of unanimity, consensus, has been modified, so now there's language, the task force shall indicate which recommendations had the unanimous agreement of the members. And that's fine. There has been movement there. So there's been movement partway to accommodate the requesters of the bill. The part that's difficult, and I just participated in a national discussion in D.C. on the issue of guest worker legislation at the federal level. And the interesting thing was there was a proposal that came before the group that was attempting to broker a compromise amongst the various interests. What was interesting was that the presentation of the brokering of the agreement had not consulted, basically, the farm worker interests, whether it was the Farm Worker Justice Fund or whether it was La Raza or whether it was the AFL-CIO, in attempting to articulate what the issues were that should be brought to the table. It's our suggestion that if we're going to have an honest discussion about what the issues are, that the prominent players at the table should be all those who are active in this issue area on a statewide basis. To deny the farm worker union or their legal representatives an equal and equitable place at the table denies you as the legislature the benefit from everyone's knowledgeable participation. And it's limited to farm worker housing. I can't see how that's going to hurt anybody's interest.
Mr. Chair, if I could, Susan Castillo, State Senator, District 20, Eugene. As I look at the original bill and look at the sponsors and the groups that have, you know, brought this forward, the original intent of this bill is to try to do something about this really very serious problem, as you know, that we have on migrant farm worker housing. And going to visit the camp again yesterday when the governor went out there was just another reminder of how we cannot continue to allow people to live in those conditions, and we really do need to do something about it. All these organizations that are on this bill, that is their intent, is to try and be helpful and put this resolution together out of the very good, noble intentions of trying to do good for some people who are in need. And we have, then we have a counterproposal that comes back and says, we're going to change a vast majority of the bill. We want to greatly reduce the composition. We want to change the composition. And I would just hope that rather than going ahead and going forward with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that instead you would have concerns about the original people who brought this forward, who now say we have concerns about what those changes are, and that we would be able to work out either, you know, some kind of a compromise on this, or but if you're going to move this forward with just saying, fine, if you don't like it, we'll take your names off the bill, I just think that it shows, in my view, a lack of concern about what all of these folks had in mind and their intentions and their hard work to put this together and what they were trying to accomplish. So I guess I just have a concern that we would go ahead and just say, fine, we'll pass this through and take your names off. We don't care whether these folks agree or not. And I guess that's my concern, if that is what is going to happen here, if you insist on going forward with changes that these groups cannot support.
Okay, thank you three very much.
What about Star Wars?
Well, that's
okay.
But it's more.
Don McCulley, could you please come forward?
I'm sorry about that.
Kim Bernaski, did you want to come forward as well?
I'd like to start out pretty quickly.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In previous discussions, which I thought were very reasonable, on the Dash 1 amendments, it's been really clear that DCBS has no business being part of this, and yet once again it shows up in the Dash 3 amendments. And Oregon OSHA was pointed out as being far more reasonable for dealing with this. I mean, DCBS is going to have very little to this, and I mean, considering how shaky it is, the vote count here, I'm really surprised that once again you're throwing this back out.
Might I respond, Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wilde, DCBS, I'm John McCulley, representing Tree Fruit Growers. DCBS is in there because that is the overall administrative agency that houses OROSHA. So the intent is that DCBS would be represented by OROSHA in the cabinet board.
Now we have that on the record. Okay.
I'm sorry. I thought I had said that at the last hearing. I apologize for that. That the intent is OROSHA, which is a part of DCBS,
okay.
That
gets
on the cabinet board
to where I'm comfortable. Okay. Thank you.
Great.
And
page 2, line 11, we're talking about one individual representing community housing development organization. And, you know, one of the things that I like about the Dash 3 is the fact that we're taking away the politics of the issue and dealing with how do we get housing. There's the issue we need to deal with. How do we get housing? So you bring in people that understand how you get housing.
Yeah. You can look at land use planning.
Individuals that know what mechanisms are out there that might be tapped in order to provide housing. You look at the, you get a farm worker Hey, what do you think? How did, what do you think how this should work? I mean,
Chairman George, for the record, Tim Bernasik, Oregon Farm Bureau, and Chairman George, I think you're absolutely correct. A few comments about this process. A comment was made by Mr. Castagna in the last testimony that we've kind of gutted and deleted a bunch of numbers off this task force and have kind of put it down to this bare bones group. But one of the purposes in doing that was at our first hearing, I don't remember which one it was, but there was discussion about the fiscal impact that this bill had, and it was rather severe. And so we were told, Mr. McCoy and I were told to go back and pare that down. We were also told to take the politics out of this, as you mentioned, and that's exactly what we've done. And another point that I'm concerned about is that Mr. Castagna commented there was no discussion with that group, and quite frankly, that's not true. I, on 3 to 4 different times, as Mr. McCoy and I were working through these amendments, tried to talk to Mr. Castagna, and we tried to work this out, and he finally told me, go back, write this up, let me see it tomorrow, and I'll get back to you. And the only time Mr. Castagna got back in touch with us, I hadn't received any communication, was in front of this committee, the last hearing, when found, he actually told me 2 hours beforehand that he didn't like the bill, it was a terrible bill, everyone was opposed to it. And that's the response we got. So I really do feel like we have put forth an effort to negotiate and work on these issues. And if I could, one final point. There's been some comment about the newspaper article that showed up this morning in the Statesman Journal. And frankly, I'm thrilled that Senator Corcoran, I believe you were there, and Governor Kitzhaber were there, because the leaders of the Clackamas County Farm Bureau, the Iversons, have been trying for 10 years to get OROSHA to move on this particular camp that you visited, to get that camp shut down. And the games that have been played between the county and that agency, when the agency shows up, when OROSHA shows up, this individual that's running this camp says, oh, no, this is rental housing, and it's the county's issue. And so OROSHA backs up, and then when the county folks show up, no, this is farm worker housing, and it's OROSHA's deal, and it's been this quagmire. And the gentleman that's been involved with this, I tried to get him to come down tonight to talk to you about this issue. His name is Steve Iverson, and I have his phone number, and if anyone would like to contact him, I would encourage you to do so, because it's an issue that we've been working on, like I say, for 10 years, trying to get this camp, camps like Camp Azul, these bad camps that are giving agriculture a black eye. We've been trying to get these things shut down. And frankly, that's the reason we're so excited about this task force, is this is an ability for us to come forward with, as Senator Chairman George, as you mentioned, folks that have a real understanding of what's at stake here. We got rid of the representative of agricultural growers, so Farm Bureau and Mr. McCauley, ourselves. We have no business being on this group. I don't run any farm worker housing. Mr. McCauley does not. We should have an honest-to-God farmer on that task force. We should have a farm worker on that task force. We should have somebody who represents community housing development that knows what it takes to get the funding mechanisms together and then other issues to make this workable. And we need someone from OROSHA, as Senator Weil talked about, that knows the regulations to get this thing built. And frankly, that was our intent in coming forward with something that's very workable, to do exactly as you said, Senator George, to take the politics out of this. And that's what we think is workable, and that's what we think makes sense. And we really encourage you to move forward on what I think is a very good idea that was brought forward by some of the religious groups and others. And frankly, we think we've improved upon it, and we ought to move forward.
That's true. I'm really touched by your interest in negotiating on this. That doesn't seem to be the pattern at all in this. It seems to be that you've come in removing the farm worker representative, farm worker union representatives, and removing the legal staff and saying that it's your way or the highway. So are you telling me that you're willing to go back into negotiation and put these people back on the group?
Second.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, we have had conversations throughout, primarily with Mr. Castagna and recently Senator Courtney, about how we can continue to work on this. At this point, our people I represent like the Dash 3 amendments the way they are. We talked after the last hearing about the consensus issue that Mr. Castagna talked to you about a minute ago. And we agreed that, yes, we could live with a change in the bill that allowed majority vote to make the recommendations, but at least those recommendations that were unanimously agreed to had to be identified. So we, you know, made some change in our proposal at that point.
So the answer to my question is?
No, at this point we're not.
Okay, thanks very much. And is it, Michael, get this on the record, is it your opinion that a representative from the farm worker union wouldn't know anything about farm worker housing? Is that your opinion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, no.
So you think they do know something about farm worker housing?
I think they may have some input on farm worker housing that would be able to be made through the deliberations of the task force. I don't think that anybody is going to be shut out from this process. The meetings will be held in public, so anyone who has any input, associations, the people I represent, whoever, will have input into the task force.
Do you think legal service organizations might have some knowledge about farm worker housing issues?
I think, Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, they probably do, just as attorneys representing growers probably have the knowledge about those issues as well.
Right. And if you were so concerned about this issue and so concerned...
Would you refer back to the chair?
Yes, Mr. Chair, another one additional question, Mr. Chair, and then I'll be done, and you can go about your merry way. If you're so concerned about farm worker housing and so concerned about the bad examples, and I saw good examples too, by the way, so... I mean, I understand that this is a bad apples issue, and there's no question in my mind about that. If you're so concerned about this, why didn't you guys put in a bill?
Chair George, Senator Corcoran, for the record, Kimber Nassick, Farm Bureau. That's a good point. I wish, in hindsight, I think that I wish we had come forward with the bill, because it's an issue that we've all talked about, and we've all see as a real issue. And I credit the folks that put this bill forward, but I also think that those of us in agriculture have some good input into this process, and I think that's what we've tried to do. And frankly, I don't agree, I guess, with your characterization that we've dug in our heels and have made everyone come our direction. I feel like we, as Mr. McCauley mentioned to you, we've come over and over and over again to try and meet the concerns of this committee. And Mr. Castagna told us that if you look at the record from the last hearing on this bill, the primary issue that he was concerned about was a consensus issue, and we have addressed that. But frankly, we think that in order to keep the fiscal impact low, which the committee was concerned about, and to get those that are best able to address this issue, we've taken groups like Farm Bureau, we're out of it, and we've taken some of those other groups as well. So you've got a focused core group, and that really was our intent.
Reality check here. I was told today anything that has a dollar figure on it, as of this point, is probably dead. So we better get the cost down or nothing happens. And so that's the choice we have. Now, under your amendments in Dash 3, let's turn to page 2 and look down at lines 25 and 26. Does it remove any part of that where it says the task force shall seek widespread involvement of persons and organizations knowledgeable? Does it remove any of
that? Mr. Chair, no, it does not. That language remains in the bill.
This group of people, this Farm Worker Housing Interim Task Force, will be, they're ordered, they're instructed that they will evaluate housing situations and that they will seek a widespread involvement of persons or organizations with knowledgeable or experience in farm worker issues.
That's
I think to me that reaches out and gets everybody back in. We're telling
you that. No, citizens don't currently have citizens.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Another guest, too. I'll be there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Bob. Yeah. Who's the author of Dash 2?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to correct the record. I'm advised that the Dash 2 amendments were prepared by Senator Castillo's office. I thought we were referring to amendments that we may have had time. I don't know if they were, maybe they were the dash ones last time, but the dash twos leave on the legal service representative as well as the farm worker union rep, so that we could live with the dash two amendments. If you wanted to graft on the language from the dash three, that the task force shall indicate which recommendations have the unanimous agreement of the members, we'd be amenable to that. So I just wanted to correct the record in that regard, and just also correct the record. These amendments have been flying back and forth given the time constraints. I've been carrying on the bulk of my conversations with Mr. McCulley, so Mr. Banasik has not been totally in the loop of the conversations. Mr. McCulley and I have had conversations that Mr. Banasik may or may not have been aware of.
Thank you very much. I'm going to make it clear. We have a third in our planning to do, rather than our planning to this committee. And one of the things I'd like to do is make it clear that it is intended this committee that on page 2, lines 25 and 26, it says the intention of this be that this will have involvement of all persons who, in fact, may be able to be of support and information and developing a process in which the legislature can be able to have. And with that work session, I'm going to move the dash 3 amendment. And is there
without objection?
First, we'll call the roll.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Dash 3 amendments are passed. And I will move to. Now, do we need to send this because it won't have a fiscal impact? I would like to. I will move Senate.
No.
Aye.
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 Aye. Okay, I will carry it.
I just want to, for the record now, you did say that as many people could attend and have input on these?
Yes, that line that I refer to actually instructs. It's on page 2, and I believe, what was that, what did I say? Line 25, 26, 27, where it talks about the fact that they shall seek widespread involvement of persons and organizations.
And you want to clarify for the record that they don't have a vote? That the farm workers union representatives don't have a vote, and that the legal services representatives don't have a vote, after the very people that carried the bill, that carried this to the committee in the first place, brought that to your committee, and you denied it.
You've not been recognized, but I appreciate your comment.
Thank you very much.
With that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Joint Resolution 38, and I'm going to,
what's your other bad one through, and we can get that everything over at once. 1267, I think.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2119. That's where we are.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we heard House Bill 2119A on the 17th, and Dr. Clark from Department of Agriculture, state veterinarian, came forward and brought to our attention that there were some technical problems with the bill. I later learned that the dash 4 amendments had been adopted by the House, and in fact they had meant to adopt the dash 5 amendments, which clarified that wolves would be an exotic animal, and you should have dash 6 amendments in front of you now, dash 86, that are those dash 5 amendments from the House. Dr. Clark has looked at the amendments, say they accurately reflect the changes that he noted needed to be made to the bill.
That's where we are. Are there any comments on House Bill 2119?
Thank you. Let's
make sure we get Wolf spelled right, or Wolf spelled right.
All right.
In about 1972, I came to a gas station had a sign out there that says, eat more lamb. 1 million wolves can't be wrong. And I asked the two young guys that were there if they didn't have a V, wolves. And he says, no, he says, my brother's just a poor speller. Didn't know how to spell. And he says, oh, yeah. He says, you want to spell lamb, L-A-M-E. I had a hard time getting out of the station without laughing.
Okay, if there's any other comment, I'm going to go ahead just to keep things moving here and move it. House Bill 2119. Is there any objection? I move House Bill 2119 to the floor with the due pass as amended.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 2119 is passed. And Senator Fisher, would you like to carry that?
Sure, I'll fix that.
Okay.
Man.
And what's going on right now? Oh, yes, you're right, actually. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2119. And I'm going to open up a work session, public hearing, if possible, work session on House Bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3496 increases acreage limit for private hunting preserves east of the summit of the Cascade Mountains from 640 acres to 1,280 acres, establishes non-resident annual private hunting preserve permit for privately owned game birds at a cost of $9, specifies that non-resident need not obtain bird waterfowl stamp, directs deposit of fees from private hunting preserve permit to upland bird subaccount of state wildlife fund. And we have Jessica Harris from Representative Lynn Ludenquist's office and Rich Berry from Department of Fish and Wildlife.
All right, I'll let you two decide who's going to go first. Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair George, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris, and I'm from Representative Lynn Ludenquist's office. As House Bill 3496 came to us from a constituent who owns and operates a pheasant ranch in eastern Oregon. This bill very simply doubles the amount of acreage available for private hunting reserves east of the Cascades, allows for changes in signage requirements, and drops from $28 to $9 the amount of money that a non-resident would have to pay to hunt pheasants and or other private hunting preserve animals in the state. It is a very simple bill, and that's all the department and has been very, very kind to help negotiate these amendments and this bill with us. We appreciate their help, and that's all.
Senator George, for the record, my name is Rich Berry, Wildlife Division Director with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. That is correct. That could be one benefit that the birds may leave the private preserve. This was brought to us by Representative Lundquist. It actually helped clear up a little misunderstanding of what type of license the individual needed on the hunting preserve, and it makes it clear. And the potential is also that the funds would be dedicated to upland bird programs. So we would support the bill as written. Senator George, if I understand your question, the birds released on a private preserve are in fact raised by the private preserve, and they must be so marked. So it is essentially a crop that they are mentioning.
That requires a license for the production,
that
so
does.
We are
by
monitoring
statute,
that.
By statute, that requires a bird preserve license.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Fisher.
Why is there an acreage limit on these issues?
Senator George, Chair George, Senator Fisher, the acreage limit is one, actually this bill increases the acreage limit, but it sets some parameters because part of the fact is they have to be, you have to also provide some buffer around other land. The information I think that Representative Lundquist had and the constituents that brought in to them, that was a workable limit, and probably will not see many up to that. But it does provide a geographic area without overflowing. Also because you cannot have one, I could not have one very close to you. So the larger mine might be, I might in fact then restrict you from having one depending on the proximity of how close we are to each other.
Mr. Fisher, I had the same question about that because, you know,
Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm. Chair
Fisher? Why you have a 3-mile limit between hunting preserves?
Senator George, Senator Fisher, the limit, I believe, was imposed, again, by statute, that it would provide a buffer for one so that I don't have, I'm not hunting up against you if you may have one. And the exact reason, I can't tell you what it was, I mean, why there was a difference between them, but it was so that with such large areas were not made that the public may not know where they are, or in fact, two adjacent parties may then be in conflict with one another as to whose birds they really were on whose land.
Mr. Chair, knowing the habits of birds like I do, if you had habitat that wasn't as good as your neighbor's, you're not going to keep yours very long anyway, or if they don't have habitat as good as yours, theirs are going to find a way over, and since birds fly, unless these are wing-clipped birds, and even wing-clipped don't last long, in keeping the bird around, I don't see what difference it makes. You don't have any limits on people hunting within 3 miles of each other, or if they're not a game farm, there's nothing that says you can't hunt fence to fence. There's no buffers, no nothing anywhere else. It seems to me a rather strange way of doing business. Unless you were going to be allowing it to be done with rifles that might carry 3 miles, I don't think a shotgun has that kind of a range. These seem to me to be pretty unnatural restrictions on an issue.
I really don't have a comment, Senator George, on what the initial intent was when the legislation was passed.
Chair George, Senator Fisher, our constituent that came to us was primarily concerned just about being able to expand his acreage and didn't raise in any way any concern about a buffer. We don't oppose a buffer.
That was exactly my feeling. Why should he have to come here? Why shouldn't he be able to enlarge it if he wants to enlarge it? I guess he posted. He certainly won't want people coming in and not paying for it. As long as he's got it posted and people can't get on it, what makes the difference is 3,000 acres or 3 million acres or whatever the case is, if it's his land.
Treasurer, Senator Fisher, I honestly am not sure. His primary concern was being able to lower the cost for non-residents and secondarily being able to expand his area. He's very pleased with this bill.
I guess, Mr. Chair, that I would be too if I got to have double the acreage on a foolish limitation. Anything would be a little bit of a help, but I guess a lot of our game laws don't make sense any more than the sales of animal parts laws make sense. We made a little headway in that too, which I was delighted, and several other people were too, but anyway, I just wanted to find out for my own benefit why you need to have some kind of restrictions when two private people that own land, whether it was 640 acres or 6 acres or 4/10 of an acre or 40 acres or anything else, could have back-to-back hunting as long as they weren't charging for it. So, you know, all I see is this is basically a restraint of trade by some other reason of the state that I don't seem to understand, and was kind of hoping you could enlighten me on this.
I hope he was asking you rather than me.
Senator Fisher, I'm sorry, I cannot.
If I could, one of the things I think we can look at. And the idea is that if in fact this does up, farmers look and say, you know what, I could probably do something with that stubble. Back here real soon. And
a little bit,
farmers and hunters react to the process. So,
I would just make one comment here. I would guess that perhaps maybe the pheasants that are released here in the west of the summit of the Cascade Mountains are inferior flyers to the ones over there. They can only get about half the distance.
Thank you.
Senator, just for your information, we currently have 45 permits that are out to 35 individuals. So some individuals, one individual, for example, has four permits of four areas of land. So that's the size in the state is 45 permits at the moment.
And I'm going to open a work session on 3496, House Bill 3496.
I will move House Bill 3496A to the floor of two pass recommendations.
Mr. Wild has moved House Bill 3496A to the floor of two pass. Is there any further discussion?
Just this, Mr. Chair. It doesn't really look like with one and a quarter of these average per county in the state, we're not really overburdening the environment with this kind of thing.
Clerk will call the roll.
Nope.
Aye.
Aye.
Right.
I'm sorry, I was out there.
Aye. Mm-hmm. House Bill 3496A has been passed to the floor with a recast. I would like to carry that.
I will carry that one. All right, I'm going to close the work session.
House Bill 3496.
I won't carry it.
Oh, do you?
I didn't carry one from here for a while.
Okay, very good.
Okay, this is another one for me.
Without objection, House Bill 3496 will be carried.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1267. Can I tell us where we are?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1267. Removes requirement that farm labor contractor give worker written statement and execute written agreement on terms and conditions of employment under certain circumstances. You have before you -3 amendments that have been submitted by John McCulley. And perhaps it would be useful to have him describe those amendments. These are intended to address concerns that came up when this bill was last before the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, John McCulley, representing Tree for Growers. Might I have Mr. Nelson from the Hood River Grower Shipper Association join me since he's been actively involved with developing of the amendment. At the last meeting you had on this bill with the amendments we had presented at that time, you had heard some concerns. First, about the application of the NAFTA side agreement on labor relative to this issue. I gave to the committee staff, and I think Mr. Nelson has copies of what we understand that side agreement is, and I'm not an attorney, but I could not find in here any specific requirements that would lead us to believe that we couldn't go ahead and adopt these amendments. So you have that now and are welcome to look at that. The other issue that came up dealt with the ability of a farm labor contractor who may also participate in this federal guest worker program from being totally exempt from Oregon farm labor contractor statute by virtue of participating in that program. And that was a loophole that we did not intend to create, and the Dash 3 amendments are presented to you with the idea of closing that, so that the only ones who could participate in the federal guest worker program and as a result of coming under all of the requirements of that program be exempt from registering as a farm labor contractor in Oregon are a farmer who already is exempt from the farm labor contracting statute, or an agricultural association. And that agricultural association you created in Senate Bill 980, and this bill makes reference to that for an association that may act as a farm labor contractor. So we've narrowed the scope so that it applies to only those two entities, and one of them, farmers, are already exempt. So actually the only exemption we're really talking about is an agricultural association. And I would let Mr. Nelson fill in the gap that I may have left out there.
Thank you. I'm Tom Nelson, Executive Director of the Hood River Grower Shipper Association. One of the other questions that was raised was that the there might be a chance that with the new guest worker program that's under discussion in Washington, D.C., the rules would be further eroded. And in actuality, the rules for the guest worker program that was proposed last year actually continue to strengthen from where H-2A is now. They do not go backwards. They go forward. And as I think everybody knows, there's some high stakes going on back there right now as people discuss what to do, and there'll probably be even more give, and the give would be toward the farm workers' rights, not the employers' rights, as they attempt to reach further compromise. And I think Senator Wyden and Senator Gordon have no intention of going backwards on any of the provisions that protect workers. Also, there was a comment about how it's hard to understand H-2A workers coming in when a GAO study mentioned that there's no shortage of farm workers. Also, in that same study, it was mentioned, and in Senator Gordon's testimony before that hearing last week, which is included in this, he mentioned that in that same study, it says there are 600,000 illegal aliens currently employed in United States agriculture. And what I think the truth is, yes, perhaps there's not a great unemployment right now, but if the INS or whatever were to happen come in, there would be a great shortage because obviously, and I don't think it's any secret, a lot of the workers are here illegal. And that's the problem employers have. They want a legal workforce. And then, of course, the NAFTA side agreement is included. And I contacted the Department of Labor and talked about enforcement issues and talked to Mr. Provincio, who is with Department of Labor, ESA, which is Employment Standards A, not Association, Agency, probably, the A part. And he has he's based in Portland, Oregon. He has 8 employees in his office. All 8 of them are authorized to go out and do enforcement work. And as he told me very strongly, they do enforcement work. I suggested that if there was a handful of H-2A applicants, would they be able to? And he very firmly told me they are very capable to do it, capable when they have enough people to do it. The Oregon Employment Department in the H-2A program has to go out and do field checks. And they're random field checks. They're also not announced. And they check to make sure that the paperwork of the H-2A program is being followed, of which there is a great deal of what you have to do. And they go out and make field checks. If they see violations, they then report them to the Department of Labor ESA. And the Department of Labor ESA then is the one that would go out if there's alleged violations and you know, work with the owner and the employee. Also, the ESA can do their own field checks. Also, within the employment office, you have the Monitor Advocate Program. And the Monitor Advocate Program also does its own field checks. And then, of course, you still have legal services and the church groups that are also out. And through all these people, again, I don't think there's any lessening of protection for workers. In fact, I would say there's probably more there's more opportunity for field checks under the DOL ESA than there is BOLI, because BOLI goes out on complaints only. These people have to go out and actually make sure things are being done and not wait for complaints. So those are some of the issues I said I would look at, and they're in this packet I gave you today.
I talked with a, well, first of all, last week we had a representative of Gordon Smith's office, and you were absolutely right, and they're maybe the line we need to address the 600,000 illegals in the country, trying to get so the issue is it needs to be a process, but they I also, the grower had complex and intense, that there are people who specialize in this to make sure that everything's lined up. The grower who had it had this facility said, oh yeah, it's dropping higher. Which would be maybe on only. Under this program, if you're willing to in scrutiny,
Mr. Alexander,
I'm glad you put on the record that there isn't a labor shortage. Thank you for putting that on the record. Did you resolve the issues that the Vice Counsel from Mexico raised with regard to the NAFTA violations?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cochran, I contacted National Council of Agricultural Employers in Washington, D.C., which is the main agricultural group that's working on the guest worker program and also is involved in the NAFTA issue. Through them, I have a copy of the NAFTA agreement, which is included in this. It's 11 pages long. They are unaware of any such violation based on Oregon law. They are unaware of how this could cause that to happen. And an example to give is that under the H-2A program, actually, they are silent on the Migrant Seasonal Worker Protection Act. Migrant Seasonal Worker Protection Act does not apply to H-2A workers. Also, the federal farm labor contractor rules do not apply to H-2A workers. And here in Oregon, as an employer, for example, Schmidt Nursery, if they, you know, bring in workers, they would not be under the Oregon farm labor contractor. So there, it is not, already there are various levels of enforcement that depends on what type of a worker you have, and it is not just uniform. Where you would get in trouble would be if you outside the law decided that H-2A workers were not going to have protection. Whatever laws you have in the state and the federal have to be followed. They have to be followed. And in what we are proposing, there is no diminishing of those rules. And I think if the rules were diminished, it would look like you're trying to bring in workers who are not going to have protections, but these rules do not diminish. These rules are, in fact, go higher up, and it's sort of an interesting reverse thing to say then, well, that's not correct. So the people I've talked to that are very knowledgeable in the NAFTA side agreement have said that they are unaware of any violation.
Another question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, of course.
It's my understanding that what you're trying to do is get an exemption for farm labor contractors from obeying the law. So I don't understand where you say that you have a higher standard.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we are asking to exempt employers from having to become a farm labor contractor just because they have gotten into the H-2A program. That's what we're trying to do. We're not trying to take a farm labor contractor and exempt him. We're trying to just take an employer or an ag association who is going to go into the A2A program and exempt them from needing to come up with $30,000. Remember, there's a monetary issue here. Come up with $30,000 in order to be a farm labor contractor in the state of Oregon to participate in the program and not have any of those Oregon farm labor contractor rules applicable or necessary. I might add, Oregon is the only state in the nation that has a bond on farm labor contractors, and that was passed, golly, 1989, and ag associations did not oppose that.
Mr. Chair, another question? So, getting back to my previous question, the Dash 3 amendments do not address the issue that was raised by the Mexican Vice Council regarding the violation of NAFTA with regards to equal treatment of workers. The Dash 3 do not address that.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Senator Corcoran, on the third page of the, sorry, there's so many papers here, the NAFTA site agreement on labor, it's a document entitled North American Agreement on Labor Cooperation about the, oh gosh, 10th page in, looks like this. That's page 1 of 11 at the top of the fat document. Okay. The third page of that talks about the responsibility of the parties to this agreement, and the parties are the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And it specifies in here what each party is to do relative to government enforcement action of labor law. First of all, early in the agreement says they have to have labor laws to protect the workers, and then it talks about how they enforce those laws. And it provides for government enforcement of a private action and the procedures that have to be followed. It's the interpretation, I think, that Mr. Nelson got from the federal group is that this site agreement does provide the protection.
Okay. The answer, I take it, is no. That you did not attempt in the Dash 3s, Mr. Chair, another question, that you did not attempt in the Dash 3s to address the issue raised by the Vice Council of Mexico.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, it's correct. We did not attempt to do that because we didn't think it was an issue that needed to be addressed.
Right. I understand your rationale. I mean, I understand why you don't think it's an issue. I just wanted to get clear that you didn't address the issue. Another question, Mr. Chair? The other fundamental issue is your characterization of the H2A program. I've been following it very closely myself. You're not attempting to say with any surety at all that you know what this thing's going to look like, are you?
Mr. Chair, Senator, you talking about the new H2A or the
mm-hmm.
guest worker program?
Mm-hmm.
No one knows what it looks like.
Thank you.
May I finish?
Sure.
I'm sorry. I said this the last time, but we have the same issue in Washington, D.C. with President Clinton that maybe is here with Governor Kitzhaber. And obviously the reason why negotiations are continuing and no bill has been dropped this year is because, in a sense, the sides have been told, which happens a lot of times here as well, you guys have got to get closer on this. And obviously the more it compromises, the more, I mean, you know, it's not going to be going backwards at all. And Senator Wyden, who's taken the lead on this, has said from the beginning that he is not going to allow workers to lose anything. In fact, he wants there to be more benefits. And in all his town hall meetings, he says it over and over and over again. So that's the base I can go on. But the H2A program has been around forever. And the worst thing that would happen is nothing happens and we're under the existing rules. And that's what my comments today are based on, the existing rules that offer all the protection.
Mr. Chair, another question. Your answer essentially was, no, you can't predict what the new proposals with regard to the guest worker program will look like. It's a very good answer. Nobody can, because there hasn't been a bill dropped. The additional question I would have is that given that you don't know what it looks like, I don't know what it looks like, Wyden doesn't know what it looks like, Smith doesn't know what it looks like, given that, what if they did pare down the protections for workers and you exempted the farm labor contractors? The workers would then have less protection than they do now, right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that could happen, but then I think I think this body could meet and they could make an adjustment. I know that sometimes you get, I from my sector, we prefer not to legislate in a vacuum. We like to have an actual target we're legislating toward, and you're right, nobody knows what's going to happen, but I think if that were to happen, I think this body here in Salem could take care of it as well.
I think it's an interesting, let's back up and start all over again. I think it is an interesting thing. We have 600,000 people who are illegal.
Mr. Chairman, that would be nice, but however, in some recent legislation, and I can't tell you where it was, sometimes you know so much it just all gets garbled up, but I know which one it was, the Reorganization, Reform Irrigation Act of 1996, the URRA versus the IRCA of 86. This is the one of 1996, I believe, where they did some fine-tuning. In that legislation, they included language that said for a worker to become involved in the H-2A process, and then there was a date certain, that worker needs to have proven they were in Mexico for, I believe, at least the previous 12 months. So for a worker, you just wouldn't be able to turn around. Also, you worker can't have his family up here because that would not show that he had been. So it's not maybe a panacea for that. And it would be up to the Mexican government to either ask for the proof of a year or to figure out if it really was. And nobody knows how that's going to play out. But that provision was included. I just one thing I didn't add was the very last page of this is an article of March 1999.
Yes.
And it has a little bit to do with the, I think, the comments made here from the Mexican consulate, who I'm not sure what he was I'm not sure where his angle was, but I do want to show that the Mexican government is very interested in the guest worker program because they are well aware of that right now workers are in a lot of peril and a lot of danger, and there's a lot of opportunities here up here illegally to be exploited, and the Mexican government realizes itself that it wants to, it would like to see that corrected and believe that some type of a guest worker type program would be appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say that actually the guest worker program should be liked by the Mexican government because, in fact, having lived in the Upper Hood River Valley, you always knew when payday was because everybody was down buying a money order or something to send back to Mexico. And, yes, a substantial amount of money did go back to the families back there. I remember it very clearly. And so, yes, it's a very great help to their economy. I would move the Dash 3 amendment, CSB 1267.
Senator Wilde has moved the Dash 3 amendment. Let's put out objection.
I will move SB 1267 as amended to the floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Wilde has moved Senate Bill 1267 as amended.
Everything comes in threes, Mr. Chair. Now we've got three racist bills this session.
I resent that.
I don't care.
I'll help you file a complaint.
Okay. Well, all right.
They're racist bills.
Okay. The first bill.
You are impugning the character of these.
No. No. Take all the action you want. I'm a no.
Aye, and I'm not a racist.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 1267 is amended.
I will, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1267, and I'm going to give the staff at the gavel. We will be adjourned, and we will head to the floor.